All right, and could you help me welcome our speaker tonight? And it is Jen F. from Port Fishington.
Oh, I like that. Could you turn this out? Here? My name is Jennifer, and I am an alcoholic. And it's really an honor and a privilege to thank you to be asked to speak in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. They asked me as I was coming in about recording me, and I don't know, the last couple of days have been a little emotional for me, so I'm like, I have no idea what I'm going to say tonight. I don't want to be held accountable on tape. Like, I don't want evidence of what I said tonight. So he said, well, we'll record you, then we'll see how, you know, how you feel about it. But my sober date is July 16th, 2007, and it's just my job tonight to tell you in a general way, really, what it was like and what it's like today and how I got here again, because when I start thinking about what I'm going to say, like, I don't know if anybody does this, but I knew a couple months ago, so I've been practicing, like, what I'm going to say and how great I'm going to sound and, you know, all this stuff. It never comes out like that. But what I get kind of jammed up with sometimes is that I've been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for years. And sometimes I don't know where some stories end and some begin. And I'm not real good with dates. You know, I don't know how old I was when this happened. And so just bear with me, really. I'll just try to piece it together the best I can. But I have a sponsor. I've gone through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I try to sponsor women the best way I can. And it's through the steps. And sometimes I'm not real successful with it, but I just keep showing up, and that's my job. I don't know. I'm from a pretty nice neighborhood in Northeast Philadelphia, and I'm the youngest of three girls. I'm the fourth one. See what I mean? I'm like a little crazy. Anyhow, you know, very kind of normal home life. I mean, it was dysfunctional, but it was normal to me. And I don't know. Like, it was funny because I have tons of CDs from speakers, and I love listening to speakers in my car, and I laugh, you know, I just, some of them are really comical, but I don't know, I didn't feel like an oddball at my house, like I didn't feel right, but I didn't feel like an alien from my family, or, like, I just didn't feel right, but I don't even know when I really knew that I didn't feel right. I know that I guess I realized it after I took my first drink. Like, I was never shy. Like, I never drank for any of those reasons, like to make friends or to, you know, I was always pretty outgoing. I always, you know, had like an upbeat little personality and would talk to anybody and, you know, I don't know. I never really had any, like, dreams in life, and I never wanted to be, like, a nurse or, like, you know, a veterinarian or nothing. Never. You know, never. You know, and I don't, you know, whatever. This is, I'm not trying to be psychology on you or anything. I don't know. You know, I just did it. But I definitely do know that, like, I can look back now. I don't remember that then, but I know now that I was 12 years old when I took my first drink. And I was hanging out with a bunch of girls, and we went up to the playground, and we had met a bunch of other kids that were up there. I never had seen them before in my life prior to this night. And I don't know the date. I know it was kind of fallish, because it was cold out, and I definitely know I was 12. And I my father owned a trucking business, so he constantly had cases of Seagram 7, or is that the whiskey, Seagram 7 whiskey, to give to truckers for the holidays. Like, he did big businesses with these truck companies. So we walk up to this playground. Long story short, we meet these kids, and this girl's like, oh, did you ever drink before? And I said, yeah. And she's like, can you get anything to drink? And I knew that that whiskey was there. And it was just like nothing. Like, I just, me and her walked to my house. I remember stealing it out the window. I handed it to her, and we walked up the street. And I remember taking the lid off it, and it touching my lips, and that's all I remembered. Like, that, the first time I ever touched alcohol was a blackout, and I don't remember. So I can't say, like, I had such a great thought. Like, I don't remember. I know I woke up and I was in a lot of trouble because they had left me on my front lawn. I was 12 years old and my parents were like, are you serious? Like, what? Just scared to death. And I remember the my friends calling me and being like, I just had a weird feeling inside me, like when I woke up that morning, like I was sick and I was hungover, but like I had this feeling, this weird feeling in me, and I kind of couldn't wait to do it again, even though I didn't remember what the hell I did. Like, I mean, that's bizarre to me, you know? I wanted to do it again, whatever it was, I wanted it again. And that was it, really. I mean, it wasn't like full-blown alcoholism at 12 years old. I started paying consequences from the door, though. There was always consequences with me because I was horrible. I got caught because I was always drinking Mad Dog or Cherry Vodka. Like, I wasn't drinking like, I never, ever, from the time I opened that bottle, I never drank to get, like, I'm good. I was never the girl like spilling the cup or like I was red cup strolling it, drinking it as fast as I could. Like, I wanted immediately. And I was always caught. Red stuff all over me all the time in my hair. And but like, it was a weekend thing and I loved it and I couldn't wait. I remember after waking up Sunday, hungover, sick, couldn't wait till Friday. Could not wait till Friday to do it again. Planning, like, now we're drinking Colt 45 and, you know, we're like, you know, Quartz, you know, it was just, you know, it was like, even though it was fun to me, I had fun. Barrels in the woods and bonfires and, you know, the boys and all that stuff. And but what happened was those group of kids that were drinking just like me, they were going home, and I was starting to be like, what? Like, I was that was already developed. Like, you know, my tolerance for it was already starting to, you know, be bigger, and I wanted more, and I didn't want to go home where before I would, you know, be passed out on the lawn. They'd be dragging me home, pushing me in a shopping cart, and, you know, now, like, we're walking home and I don't want to go home no more. But now I'm starting to think, you know, I'm lying now to my friends because I'm starting to feel a little different because, you know, it's over for them and it's not really over for me. Like, I'm just getting started and they want to go home. And I'm like 15, 16, and where I'm from, there's a project. It's a, you know, a housing project. And that's where we would go to drink because these kids that I had met lived in Lindenfield Project, and they had older, you know, siblings that hung up at the store. They would get us our they would get us alcohol. You know, we never had a problem. Never. I never had to pay somebody to go get me liquor or nothing. Like I was old. We never had a problem getting it. And you know, but I remember walking home, and everybody went in because the girls I grew up with. When I went up the playground that night and met those other kids, we all lived in a two-block radius. Like, one girl lived right across the street from me. So I was like, we walked all the way home, and I'm like, is she in? And I remember walking back down at, like, 15 years old to go hang out with their older brothers to drink. Like, I'm hanging out with, like, 37-year-old men now drinking on the corner. And because it's not like they're going home, it's not enough for me. And I know where to get still more, you know. And with that, at 15 years old, like, I was introduced to other forms of alcohol. Like, you know, being out, I'm hanging out, 36-year-old men, they're drinking on the corner. And, you know, they're giving me other things to keep me drinking. And, you know, I don't really know at, you know, I don't really know. I know that I started paying prices like right around then, like 15, 16 years old. Like, you know, my life started to become very difficult. And I was starting to separate myself from those friends. And I was starting to do some stuff that, like, they weren't doing. You know, they were graduating high school. They were going to proms. Like, I never went to a prom. I never graduated high school. I don't even know how I got through 8th grade. I really don't. They kind of just pushed me. Like, we're sick of seeing you. Like, please, go to high school. I never, like, went. And, you know, it's funny because I have a 12-year-old little girl. And I look at her, and I'm like, oh, my God, like, I took a drink at 12 years old. And she's so, this little angelic face and beautiful. And I'm like, my God, like, it scares me, you know. And, God, she's nothing like me at all. Anyhow, you know, I just need to say, so 15, things are bad. So 16, things are getting really bad. And I'm in my first rehab, 16 years old. First time ever introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, so that's where it starts for me. It's 16. I am 39, and I have 3 years of sobriety. So from 16 years old, I've been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been really a very hard road, and things were bad, and they got worse, and then real bad, and it just keeps getting worse and that. So I'm just going to try to, I go to this rehab at 16, and I'm in a lot of trouble. I stole the car. I sideswiped every car going up the block. All the paint, there was 17 different color paints on it. Like, there was no, I didn't do it. It wasn't me. You know, I woke every neighbor up on the, you know, they knew it. I was caught. I was done. And I think I had seen one time being up all night, like, remember they used to have commercials for rehab or something? They would come on, like, if you need help, like, at 3 in the morning, you're like, I remember, like, seeing one of them and being like, I need help. Like, I need, you know, that's a good idea. I knew, like, that would get me out of, like, you know, because my parents were, like, really, like, sick to death. I'm like, you know, I'm a hot mess. And I have 3 older sisters that are a hot mess, too. And I look, like, I make them look, like, wonderful, you know. I was always the one getting caught. It was just, you know, but I go to rehab and, like, I don't know, God has always been with me, and I am so grateful for that. that I've always had some type of connection with God, and I don't really know where it came from, because I remember being in school. I went to a Catholic school, and they kind of scared me a little bit about God. But I never perceived God like that. Like, I always really loved God, and I don't know how that happened. I just am very grateful that I had that. And, like, I went to this rehab and at 16 and heard some stuff. I remember this lady coming in, and she was really, really pretty. And she came in to speak to us. And I was in an adolescent unit, and everybody, you know, it just, like, people were court committed. It was just a little crazy. And I remember listening to her and her saying about going to AA when you get out. And I remember identifying with her story. I could not tell you what she said, but I know that I was like, I felt like that, or I drink like that, or somewhere I identified with her. And I remember thinking, I'm going to go to AA when I get out of here. And I did. I walked. It was so crazy because I got a meeting book. And when I walked out of that rehab, you know, I wasn't the, you know, because you know how they're in rehab, people, places, and things. And, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days and all that stuff they try to instill in you, you know, that you have to make meetings to contact AA when you get out and, you know, stay away from the people you were just out with. And I, you know, I'm 16. I'm like, that's not happening. Like, I'll go to these meetings, but I'm not stopping hanging out with my friends, you know. So I had walked into the AA meeting, and it was right, I swear to God, it was two blocks from my house. And I walked in, and it was real smoky, and everybody just seemed, like, ancient to me. And I just was like, yeah, I can't. I don't see myself doing this, really. And my girlfriends met me, and I think I stayed sober for about 3 days. Really, like trying, like wanting to go back or whatever. And yeah, I probably lasted about 3 days, and I winded up drinking again. And I don't even know what to say. Like, you know, I was doing powder forms of alcohol. Then it was like in a cooked form, and I was just drinking. I can't even paint you the picture. It was like, you know, watch a Stephen King film, and that's kind of how it looked like. It was very scary, and it just got bad. And by 19 years old, I was back. That meeting had moved to a different place, and I don't, like, I can't even tell you, like, how I even found it, or I don't even know, but I had went to the same meeting, but it was in a different location. It was years later, and I had walked up, and it looked a lot different to me. The people were younger, and everybody was happy. There was a lot of brand new sneakers going on, and I'm serious. And I was attracted by that. A lot of gold hanging from the neck, a lot of tans going on, like really, but people looked like really good to me. They looked like they had their stuff together, like, you know. I really, like, they did, you know, and the girls came up to me and they gave me their phone number, and, you know, I didn't even know what the hell I was doing. I let the girl drive me home, and the next thing you know, she was there the next day to pick me up. I was like, so I kind of just went with it, you know, just don't drink, you know, God's in the coffee pot. And this meeting that I had gone to was around the clock, and it was insane, and I loved it. They were playing pinochle. I mean, the business meeting, I remember, like, chairs being thrown, you know. I mean, it was really, this one guy was cheating on his wife. She came in the middle of the meeting, threw her shoe with the, like, it was just, and I loved it. I was like, I loved it. You know, now But, like, here's the clincher of it all. And this is the deception of it. And because I don't know this, but I am a real alcoholic. And I have, like, a hole in my soul that I don't even know. I have no clue that I'm, like, a total alcoholic. And I see this, and it's nobody's fault, you know what I mean? But I wasn't hearing anything really about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Or, you know, I got sober, and these girls picked me up, and they really helped me, like, the best they could. And they would bring me to meetings, and I remember the one girl bought me, like, a Tannin package, and, you know, like, they thought they were helping me, and, you know, I thought that's what sobriety was about. Like, I walked in there at 19, and I had nothing. I just crawled out of, like, a crack house. You know what I mean? And I come to AA, and, you know, I don't have nothing, you know, so I get my permit. I get a license. I bought a car. Like, my life is starting to look good on the outside. And because of those outside things, temporarily, the inside's being, like, a little, like, it's, like, corked. Like, or something, like Band-Aids. I always say Band-Aids over the Grand Canyon. Because that's how I felt. Because I would put a Band-Aid over it. I would get, like, the tightest jeans I could put on. I'm not kidding. And I'd come in about 8:05 to walk through this meeting. Like, I was insane. I was so twisted. I was dying for attention, for relief, for something. But I thought I was doing good. I didn't know why I still, like, I felt like this. I thought I was insane. I would be in 17 different chairs in a meeting. I'd be up getting coffee. I'd be down. I'd be going to the bathroom. I would just be up and down. Going to get the basket. Counting them on, like, insane. They used to have this big bar, too, at this meeting, and I would sit on it, and there was a mirror, and I could see who was coming in the meeting. It was just, like, really. But I thought I was doing good, and it seemed like I was. You know, I started to acquire things. And even though it was temporarily, I didn't know that these things were going to give way. I had no idea what the doctor's opinion was saying. Like, a big book meeting. I was like, big book. Like, I'm not wanting no, like, I would be really highly agitated. If it was a big book meeting, I'd be, let's go to the story in the back. Like, nothing. Well, that's where they went anyway. There was never, like, the first 164 pages going on. You know, I just was highly agitated, but you couldn't tell me anything. Because by this time, I'm, like, a year and a half sober. You can't penetrate me. I need to be swept up within 3 days while the severity and the desperation's still upon me. You give me 3 days, I forget. I don't remember. I can't bring that back with all the money in the world. That feeling of leaving my kid and all that crap. Like, I'm a year and a half sober. You can't tell me nothing now. Like, I'm doing good. What are you talking about? I have this chair. I've taken 17 people to detoxes. Like, I'm doing this. They talk about service. I'm cleaning ashtrays. I'm making coffee. I have a commitment. I'm doing good, you know. And 3 years sober comes. I speak. And, you know, I would have wore a goddamn prom gown if I could have. Like, I really thought, like, I was really nuts, you know, just dying. And just those instant things weren't working no more for me, you know. And I just was really insane and didn't know it. And it's sad. It's really, really sad. Because I see it all the time. And I remember speaking for 3 years. I remember, like, pounding on the desk, like, with total conviction. And if you would have hooked me up to a lie detector test, I would have passed. Because I believed myself. And I had no idea about really the wrath of alcoholism and what this disease was about. No clue. And I swore to God I'd never take a drink again. And I was drunk the next day. I was drunk the next day. Somebody handed me a Valium and I took it. I had no idea. I had no clue about a defense, that I was powerless. Like, I knew the powerless piece, but that was it. Like, the steps, that's what the steps consisted of for me. On this shade, hanging on the wall. Like, I'm dead serious. Like, it wasn't, you know, step meetings and I got women in my life that are telling me I'm doing good and that, whatever. I drank and I hadn't drank in 3 years. And now, like, all kinds of stuff's going on. See, I had never, like, I kind of always drank in the same neighborhood and then went home, you know, but I got introduced to a different neighborhood and a whole different set of playing rules. And it's in Kensington, Philadelphia. And I'm sure you've heard a lot of speakers or maybe you've even visited there. But I don't know. There's people that live down there and have great lives. People bought their houses when they were like 30. They don't want to move. Little old ladies that love their neighborhood. But I just was like, this is great, this place. I didn't even know people really lived there. Like, I thought they only went there to do drugs. Like, I just thought it was like, I swear to God that I had no idea. Like, I was really delusional. And I remember, like, even though I would go down there and do what I did, I would wind up getting home somehow. And like, I remember the day that I can't tell you what year or whatever, but I remember the day came that I couldn't leave any longer. Like, when the sun came up. And I just want to say, in the meantime, like, in AA, that 3 years, I had met a guy in AA, and we got together, and that was a really poisonous relationship, and I was off and on with him for years. I wound up marrying him, and we had a little girl together, and I have a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful 12-year-old little girl that I tortured her life. And by this time, I'm in and out of AA, and I wind up getting high, and I think I got sober like a couple months later and winded up stringing like, maybe 6 months together again, and then got high again. And, I just couldn't get, because what happened was when I got, after that 3 years and you accumulate, like, in my mind, sobriety was about like monetarily or possessed, like, I don't know. But it wasn't about the steps of our, or, searching in fearless moral inventories. Like, it had nothing to do with any of that. And God, or opening, cleaning, nothing. And I never really heard that. And I don't know if my ears were just too deafened that I couldn't hear, but I couldn't hear it. And I, from that point on up until 3 years ago, I was in and out. And I mean, I would string time together. Like, I would get 16 months together. I would get 90 days together. I would get enough. And when I tell you, like, the desperation, I would have gave my arm. I really would have given a limb to get sober. Because I was just so desperate. I was so broken that I would have did anything. I really would. I'm like, the hopelessness and the despair. Like, I never came back to AA to save face. Like, what? I don't know. Like, I always came back here with my ass beat. Like, alcohol, like, the four horsemen were in my living room, and I showed up in AA the night. Like, the terror, and, like, I just couldn't. And it was always the grace of God. I'd have that moment of sanity, like, to make a phone call. Or I would call my ex-husband, because he was, like, sober so long. And they'd get me into a rehab, and I'd probably meet a boyfriend, and I'd get out. You know, just craziness. I just couldn't get it together. And you know, I'm leaving my daughter. Like, I'm just going to fast forward it a little bit. But when somebody opened the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous with me, I was floored. I was floored. And I it was a combination of a lot of events that had taken place in my life at that time for me to even be able to hear. Because I was like, oh, my God, like, I understand, like, why I'm doing this and why I can't stay with my kid. Because they told me about being sober for a period of time and then the obsession coming on me and not being able to not drink. And I knew that, but I never was able, like, I didn't understand what was wrong with me. And I remember going back in my mind, I was 6 months without a drink. And I was, let my ex-husband let me stay with him because he was so afraid I was going to die. And he let me stay with him and my daughter. And it was around Christmas. And I was 6 months without nothing. And I remember I was going to a meeting and I had left. And while I got in the car, the obsession came over me, right? But I had money stashed in the house. Like, I was, you know, I probably stole it, but I most likely really did. But I had money. Right? Now, I'm on my way to the meeting, and this comes upon me. And I mean, I'm done. It's got me by the throat. I can't even think. I'm already sick. I don't even have it in me. I haven't had it in me in 6 months. And I am so twisted by the force of this obsession. I go in my car. I turn around. I go in the house. Now, my daughter was a cherub. Like, this little chubby, curly hair, beautiful girl. Still is. I mean, drop dead gorgeous. And I'm not just saying that because she's mine. But she is in, like, you know, those zipped up with the footsies on. And it's Christmas. And I think she had reindeers on them. And, you know, I was doing really good 6 months. And this obsession is upon me. And I'm done. I go in the house, I grab the money, I'm nuts, right? Now, I'm walking at the door, and she grabs my leg and wants me to watch Frosty the Snowman, and I can't. I don't even have a drug in me, and I can't stay. I have to go. I shake her off my leg, and I'm gone. Like that. I'm in Kensington, and I'm missing for another month and a half, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, you know. I don't know. You know, when he opened that book with me and we talked about, because I was like, what is, like, that guilt when you come to, I got to keep getting high because I just got high. Like, I just got high, so now I got to keep getting high. Because I can't even deal with what I just did. And I don't understand that it's not, I can't even control it. That I need God in my, I have no clue what the solution is to any of this. I think I am the worst possible piece of garbage there is on this earth.
I remember seeing school buses going by, and I'd be coming out of these houses, and it'd be the sun's coming up, and I want to rip my face off. There's nothing left. I did it again. I got no money, and it's bright outside. Ew. Is that not like the worst feeling in the world, it being bright out? And there goes a school bus. And I don't know why that would bother me so bad, but it would kill me. I would be like, I'd have to go get more. I'd have to. And then for God, the grace of God, somebody would see me that knew me from AA and would try to rip me off the street and just, you know, get me in a detox or whatever. And I kept trying to do what I did at 3 years sober. I would come back to AA and I would try, like, I would think in my mind, if I could only get that back, I'd be okay. And that wasn't the case at all. So I wind up doing other things now that I am really, like, not proud of myself about. Now I'm using alcohol in a syringe form, and I am like a hot mess. And I don't even know how this happened, because my dad never, like, my dad was old. Like, I have older sisters, like I said, and they, you know, they get high too. And it could be all four of us in the house getting high, and he'd be like, you, meaning me, get out. Like, I'd be like, what about them? Like, I always had to go. Because I think I would go missing a lot of the time. Like, they would be home doing what they're doing, and he would see them day after day. But me, I'd be on, like, a milk carton. Like, have you seen her? Really. I mean, for date. Like, just a mess. And he'd be like, you gotta go. Get out. And I'd say, like, July, I don't even know, 13th. 2007, I was just, you know, I was like, just wasn't really anything different. Scamming, lying, cheating, whatever, stealing. And I'm like a mess. I'm bruised from head to toe. I have a habit now, and I'm doing other things. You know, I'm a mess. And, I fall asleep. I sleep the clock around. I wake up, and I had slept 24 hours. And I remember walking. I was still at home. That's what I was trying to say about my dad. I don't know how it happened, but I was still at home at this point. I'm like a hot mess. And I think he was so afraid, too. Like, you know, that fear of your parents. Like, he was scared. He was really scared for my life and sanity at that point. And he let me stay, I guess, or I don't know. But I was still at my dad's and getting high this whole time. So I had fallen asleep, and I had walked into the bathroom. And I remember the thought came upon me, like, you have 24 hours sober. Like, it doesn't even matter how you got it. You have it right now. Like, do something. And then I thought real quick, well, let me get $10 and I'll do something tomorrow. That was always my, like, tomorrow. And I don't even know what happened. I made a phone call. And with that phone call came a girl, like, I can get you in a halfway house, pack your stuff, like, get your stuff together. And I am still, like, my humility is, like, wasn't in my nature. Like, I could be crawling out from under a rock, and they'd be like, you need to go to a halfway house. I'd be like, me? Like, just so really nuts. Like, just, you'd, like, want to punch me in my face, like. So I swear to God that the grace of God, I was, because I had nothing. I had no desire to get sober. It wasn't like I was burning with desire. I had nothing. I had nothing. But you know what I had going for me? I was broken. And, like, every Band-Aid I ever had on that Grand Canyon of that hole in my soul was exposed because I felt like you could see through me. I felt like I had a shock, like, huge hole in me. I was just, like, done. And I knew I could manipulate my dad. I knew I could get 10 more dollars. I knew I could just keep this going a little bit longer. And God did for me what I could never do for myself. Because I packed up that dirty-ass room with those dirty clothes, and I threw them in a laundry basket, and I winded up in a halfway house at Survive in Cumberland. And that's when my journey began. And I had no idea, because it felt like, if you would have asked me, that felt like the worst possible thing that could have ever happened to me in my life, was that halfway house and all that. Like, I was sick. I couldn't, no detoxes were taking me anymore. Like, it was a wrap. It was over. And I was really, I felt like this is the worst. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me in my whole life. Backing up real quick because I know I'm running out of time. But I was on this run in North Philadelphia in Kensington with this kid, and his name, I'm going to keep out of this CD. And he's from Croatia, and that's all I'm going to say about that. But I had met him prior. I had met him in a rehab, and, you know, he was a nice guy, and he talked about AA or whatever, and I winded up seeing him outside of AA when I got out of AA. I met this kid in rehab, and I was running around with him in Fishtown or something, and I met this kid, and he was a nice guy or whatever, and then I was out on this vicious run, and I run into this kid, this Croatian kid. And now I'm on this run with him. And I mean, he is just as bad as me. And we're ready to fist fight over $10. Like, it was just horrible. I mean, horrible. And I wind up in this halfway house. I'm just trying to fast forward the situation to you. What I want to say, too, is that I'm in this halfway house, and I have a little, like, a speck of light in me, and I'm from the Northeast, so I'm taking two buses back up to that meeting where the tan people are and with the gold, because that's all I know. That's all the place I've ever gotten sober in my life was in that group. So I'm taking two buses back to this meeting that now I'm feeling like a loser in, because they're like, when are you going to get it, kid? Like, I'm sitting in Alcoholics Anonymous with people telling me, you were around AA. You weren't really in AA. You were around. You know, they were like, you just really don't want it. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, yes, I do. So I'm walking to get on the bus at Frankfort and Cumberland to go up to the Northeast to make this meeting that I feel like killing myself in. Right? So I'm walking by Cumberland and Trenton and Cumberland, and there's all these people out there. Now, I know I had been at that meeting before, but I really don't remember. I remember not liking it because it was an hour speaker meeting. And I wanted to share. Probably. Like, who do they think they are speaking for an hour? Like, so I was walking by to catch the bus, I swear to God, and this is how the grace of God has worked in my life from that day on. I hear him call my name, this Croatian gentleman, and his voice is very distinct to me. And I'm like, at first I got like, whoa, you know, like, I don't know what kind, whatever. So I look over and there's a million people out front of this meeting. And I mean, I didn't know really what was going on at the point. So he calls me over and I'm like, he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm going to a meeting up, you know, so and so. And he's like, no, you're not. You're coming with me. And it was like 3 minutes before Trenton and Cumberland, Port Fishington was starting. That's on Monday nights at 7:30. So come on in. But he was like, no, you're not. You're coming in here. Like 3 minutes later, I sat up in the front and I heard this guy speak. I don't know who he was and I don't know what he said. But I know he talked about a solution and a hole in the soul. And you couldn't have peeled me off that seat. Like, I didn't move that whole hour. I was like, I couldn't even, my ears heard every word this guy said. And he talked about feelings. I could never get out of my mouth. I could never put words upon what I felt. He talked about, you know, the powerlessness and the mental obsession. And I was pissed that there was a solution to this. I have to tell you, I was pissed off. Okay. I really was. So after the meeting, I'm hysterical. I'm like, you gotta help me. I'm asking him. And he does. And he tells me to go, you know, whatever. So he meets with me and we go through. And I had the first step on the corner of Kensington and Summerside. Like, I knew I was powerless. My life was very clearly unmanageable. And when he took me through the rest of the steps and when he, you know, just being willing, like, God, like, you know, restoring me to sanity. And my biggest hurdle was in the third step, because I'm a very tangible girl. Like, I like tangible evidence. I like to see it, smell it, touch it. Like, I like to know it's here. Like, you know, when they talk about a God and, you know, even though I believed in God, see, this is the difference, right? Because I loved God and I believed in God, I had no faith in God. And they are two very big differences. And because I remember wanting to get sober, I'd be in adoration, these chapels. I'd be lighting candles. I'd have rosary beads. I would have drank holy water if it would have worked. Like, I was always seeking God. I just never opened the chapel. Like, I didn't know I had a very short window of time. That's why I said earlier, like, I don't remember within 3 days. Like, that pain and suffering, like, it's gone from me. I don't know how anybody else drinks, but when it was explained to me, I could understand that. Jennifer, you're done in 3 days with no action. You're done. Like, give me a week and I'm tanning and I need a cell phone and I have a demand list again. And, you know, it's crazy because I think, you know, whatever. So he takes me through the first two steps, and which really were just conclusions. And the only real action in the third was for me to, you know, humble myself to God. And when I tell you that my whole life, I swear to God, like when it says in the third step, you will be reborn, I was reborn. Like, I turned my will and my life over to God. I was like, I felt like I just didn't even care anymore. Like, I just was like, fine. Like, a lot of the time, I was very reluctant with them. I was like, who's going to pay my rent? Because I, you know, was still kind of living a little slimy. Like, you know, having my rent paid, cigarettes and this and that. I'm like, well, who's going to? He's like, you got to stop all of it. It's done. It's over. And he told me I had to get a job. And I was a little appalled. But I was like, fine. Like, I was just whatever. And I really, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I cannot stress that enough. Because I didn't think a whole lot. I just did. I just moved. I just was like, whatever. All right, fine. Come on. And when I went to meet with him and, you know, we did the third step prayer and he was like, you got to let go of all this. Like, God is your employer, Jennifer. Like, he's got you. He's had you this whole time. So I'm like, all right, fine. So I kneeled down with him. I humbled myself to God and he was like, all right, well, go get writing. And I didn't even care because I had been on a run with him. So I knew he was a little shady himself. So I was like, I don't mind doing a fist that with you. So I wrote everything down, and we did, you know, we had did a fourth, and I wrote in fifth and sixth and seven, and, you know, he winded up picking up right before my ace sap list. You know, it was already written. I mean, whatever. So before we really went over, like, what I was going to do and what I was going to say and all that stuff, before I ventured out and started doing these things, we were going to meet to go over it, and he winded up picking up. And God put someone else in my life immediately, and I have a wonderful sponsor today, and I love her to death. And I've made a lot of amends in my life, and like, I can't even begin to tell you that what my life looks like today. Like, that little 12-year-old girl that I, like, would wring her hands when I would go to Wawa. Like, is she coming back? Or when I would go into the bathroom, she'd be pounding on the door. Or, like, never. Like, just constantly a mess. Like, she had to do a project on a role model. Like, and I was her role model. Like, I take her to soccer. She's in choir. Like, I have her all the time. Like, I'm not only, like, exist in her life. I'm like a force in her life. You know, and she just, she wrote such beautiful things about me. And I was like, who told you to write that? And, like, my work consists of, I take care of two elderly people that are old, like 93, my little lady is. And I don't even know how these people, like, God is, I would never choose this type of work for myself. Like, it kind of just came up on my lap. I take care of an 87-year-old man that's got dementia, and I love them so much. And I feel bad, and I know that people abuse these elderly people. I'm just there, and I work for God, and I got married, and I just got it. Like, none of that shit means anything. I'm not, because I know monetarily, like, I got married because the hole in my soul was filled, and he was like a match for my soul. Like, it wasn't because I needed him or because... We were just equal. And we just bought a house 3 months ago. And we'll be married 2 years in December. And, you know, I just found that, well, I'm 4 months pregnant. And, you know, my life is just, if you would have asked me in a year of sobriety, like, really, what do you want? I would have sold myself short. Because God has given me way more than I could ever imagine. And I don't have, like, you know, huge thing. I struggle to pay my mortgage. Like, not struggle, but, like, it's check to check and peanut butter and jelly for dinner. But we're happy. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, I don't have, like, I love shopping at thrift stores. And my husband's always screaming at me, like, would you go buy yourself something? Like, I love thrift stores. I don't care. Because none of that makes me, who, like, none of that works for me. It's God. It's seeing somebody at Wawa that maybe wants some money, and I know they're in a bad way, and I don't give it to them, but I'll go buy them a cup of coffee. Or just to be nice, or just, you know, put my hand out and to be of service to God's children. And but here's the truth. This same solution I have is for everybody here. It's no different. It's no, like, you know, and I want to tell you this, and I'm going to shut up, because, like, those three sisters of mine, I'm the youngest, like, are a mess. Like, are a mess. Like, I just had to take custody of my little niece. She's 9. I've been trying to get them both in a detox. Well, really, all three of them for the last 2 days. And you know what's really sad? There's no detoxes anymore. Like, they're not funding anybody. Like, as desperate as you are, like, they're not funding you. Like, they're building jails and mental institutions. Like, that's it. Like, she called me 2 minutes before I walked on here to speak that they weren't keeping her. Like, Kensington Detox wasn't keeping her. And she was getting on the aisle to come home. And I said, you know, there's hope still. Like, there's hope. Like, I would give you what it is to, like, your family, like, my sisters. My God, I would give this to them if I could, you know? And they look at me like I'm the Antichrist. They're like, out of this, bitch. Where's your big book? I'm like, in my purse. You know, but like, and so I am not sometimes a great example of Alcoholics Anonymous when I roll in there and they're like all crazy looking. I'm like, you, sir, what are you doing? Like, sometimes, like, I can, you know, I'm not. And I struggle day at a time. Like, I don't walk along perfect lines. I really don't. I struggle. But Alcoholics Anonymous and God have saved my life. And the same solution is here for you, too. And that's all I have.